joining us, and I appreciate everything you're doing inside. You're one of my good examples. And
thank you, Mr.
Of course. Thank all of you for listening. Thank you, baby.
I appreciate your support as well.
Okay.
You and all the staff of Fair Chance Project and Families United to End Life Without Parole. Thank you.
Thank you, sweetie. So you've been listening to Think Outside the Cage on KPFK. It's me and Gary all the way. Thank you so much, Gary, for everything you do to keep us together. Jesse Bliss will be here next week. See you in 2 weeks.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's program, we look at the second round of elections in France and in Iran, both yielding surprise results that we could characterize as historic, especially in France, and to be seen in Iran. Sebastian Budgen returns to explain the French results, which put the radical left New Popular Front in the strongest position in parliament, an upset for Le Pen's far-right RA and Macron's center. We'll ask Sebastian how the various organizations of the left were quickly able to come together in their new alliance, how they achieved agreement with the center to get candidates and constituencies with 3 or 4 candidates to withdraw so that only the strongest candidate could face down the rightest candidate, and what comes next. With the radical left now the majority force in France's parliament, we'll get Sebastian's take on the challenges it faces in implementing the popular proposals in their platform and whether they can continue the alliance with the center to thwart the right. Yasemin Mather then joins us to explain the surprise result in Iran's second round. At a moment when the hardliners seemed fully in control, the Iranian people elected a moderate reformer, Masoud Pezeshkian, as president by a margin of 3 million votes over the regime insider and hardliner Ali Jalili, who mouthed all the regime's hardline positions on internal security and foreign policy. It's a dramatic turn of events, signaling the population's desire for change. Pezeshkian focused on social reforms, economic improvement, and renewed nuclear negotiations. And he won. But his success depends on the Supreme Leader's approval. We'll get Yasmin's understanding of this result and ask if it sets the stage for potential change in Iran, where the nation is grappling with deep-seated discontent, geopolitical turmoil, a crippled economy, rampant corruption, and a repressive regime. All this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to the program. I'm Susie Wiseman. We spoke to Sebastian Budgen a few weeks ago, just ahead of the first round of France's snap election, called by President Macron after the far right swept the European elections, threatening to do the same in France. It was a gamble for the highly unpopular Macron. He was betting that the left would be unable to get past its divisions and that his center would prevail against Marine Le Pen's RA, or National Rally. He lost the gamble, threatened with the possibility that the RA could come to power on its racist, authoritarian, anti-immigrant and xenophobic program or platform. The French left united and created the New Popular Front, a coalition of leftist, pro-labor, pro-immigrant and environmentalist parties. The new alliance not only rallied, they pulled off an historic upset in the second round of the election, emerging as the largest bloc and biggest force in the new National Assembly or Parliament. It's nothing short of extraordinary, something we here in the United States, facing a very grim electoral outlook in November, should try to emulate, even with our very different political system. The left in France are now the largest force in what will be a hung parliament, with a tripartite political field divided between the left in the New Popular Front, Macron's centrist bloc, and a Le Pen-dominated right-wing pole. We'll get Sebastian's understanding of how the left won, the challenges they face in broadening their support and winning elements of the program. Sebastian, welcome back. Before you we jump in, I just want to let the listeners know that you are editorial director for Verso Books, also on the editorial board of Historical Materialism, and you've been analyzing French politics for us many years now, and write about it as well. And we're talking to Sebastian in the Dordogne in France. How we wish we could be with him. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Susie. Good to be back.
So we spoke to you just before the first round when it looked like Marine Le Pen's RA would win the most seats. That didn't happen. Macron's gamble that the left wouldn't get past their squabbles and that he would win utterly failed. The New Popular Front mobilized and candidates willingly withdrew in 210 constituencies to present the strongest candidate against the far right, and it worked. Can you explain how the left did this so quickly, how both the left and center realized the danger of the right and respected each other enough to withdraw their own candidates in order to defeat the right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right to say, Susie, that it was an extremely surprising result. It was on the back of an extremely acrimonious European election campaign in which the left had participated divided and very acrimonious in terms of criticisms from various parts of the left to other parts of the left and so on. Everyone was taken by complete surprise when Macron called the snap election, and there was only 3 weeks to unite, to get a common program, to divide up the constituencies between the different left parties, to run a campaign for the first round of the legislative elections, and then a week later, the second round of the legislative elections. So it was a completely tumultuous and a crazy period of time to run anything like a political campaign. Just to remind listeners, the French political system for the legislative elections is a first-past-the-post system, but with two rounds. As the common phrase goes, you choose in the first round and then you eliminate in the second round. And so the Rassemblement National, the RN, did incredibly well in the European elections and then did very well in the first round of the legislative elections. And so the question immediately posed on the following Monday morning was how to react to that vote. And the left, without hesitation really, decided to call for a tactic of standing down systematically in all seats where there were three or four cornered contests, because if you win over 12.5% in the first round, you get to stand in the second round. So they decided to choose to stand down systematically in all seats where the RN came first, and where there were two other parties, including themselves. This was a very big sacrifice because it meant basically handing over a whole number of seats to the Macroniste center, so-called center, and even to the Républicain, which is the remnant of the traditional right-wing party in France. They did it, and their electorate acted in a very disciplined way, I have to say. There was a very big turnout. More than two-thirds of the population voted. It's the highest turnout since 1997, I think, including in rural areas, but also inner city and banlieue areas. Something like 70% of the left electorate voted for their political opponents, their adversaries, against the RN. In general, the center candidates, the Macroniste candidates, also stood down, although there were several cases where they didn't. And in general, their electorate acted in a more ambiguous way. About 50% voted for a left candidate when they were in the position of strength against the RN, going down to only about 40% when the left candidate was from the more radical wing, La France. The result of all that was that although the RN got got the biggest vote. They got a very impressive vote of more than 10 million, which is a very big increase on the previous legislative elections in 2022. They also doubled their number of seats in the parliament. The remarkable, magical result we saw in terms of the electoral results that nobody was really expecting, I wasn't expecting it, I don't know anybody else who was really expecting it, was that the left, the New Popular Front, came first in terms of the number of seats, the Macroniste came second, and the Rassemblement National came third. And this obviously was in a context where for the previous 3-4 weeks or more, the only question that was being posed by the media and others was how strong would the majority be for the Rassemblement National? Would it be an absolute majority? Would it be a relative majority? What ministers could you imagine in this awful government that they would create? What measures would they push through in the first few days and weeks and so on and so forth? And yet they came third, which they did very, very well. They consolidated and extended their vote. But the electoral logic of having this two-round system is that they were pushed into third place, which is a massive defeat for them. It was also a big defeat for the Macroniste, if you compare to the number of seats that they had in 2017 when Macron was elected president, or even in 2022 when they lost their absolute majority. But it has to be said that, you know, they got more seats than you would have expected, thanks essentially to left-wing voters deciding to vote for them against the far right.
That's really great. Thank you for all of that. I think just for an American audience, it would be good to explain a little bit, because I think, you know, what the left did in France along with the center is a model that, you know, should be repeated everywhere when there is such an opponent to defeat. And it would be great here if all shades of center and left united to defeat Trump. That is another question for another program. And you described how they did it. But now what I really wanted you to explain is this first past the post in the elections in the two rounds. But yet when we get to the parliamentary system, isn't it proportional representation that you have?
No.
All right. Explain that.
No, it is a first past the post system in the same way as the British system is first past the post. So there's no proportional representation, and that's a source of a great deal of injustice, which the left still, despite the fact that they were the conjunctural beneficiaries of it. So it is a very unfair political system. It's less unfair than the British system, because in the British system, you only get one vote. You get to vote for the candidate you want to vote for. And obviously, that means that any smaller parties or insurgent parties are immediately or generally speaking eliminated. In the French system, you have two rounds. You have first round where you vote for what your heart wants, i.e. you vote for the candidate that's closest to your political beliefs. And then a week later, depending on who gets through to the second round, who gets more than 12.5%, you get to vote for your head, i.e. who do you want to eliminate? Who's the biggest danger, as it were? So it's a classical form of tactical voting. In French, it's called the Republican Front, which is a rather pompous name for it, because the notion that parties are all defending the values of the Republic against the anti-Republican parties, which is full of hypocrisy and cant when it comes particularly to the Macroniste and the right-wing Républicain. But nonetheless, that's the name for it. And it's a principle that has been applied very strongly in French politics. The sort of classic example everybody will remember is from the presidential elections of 2002, which was the first time that Jean-Marie Le Pen and the far right got through to the second round against Jacques Chirac, the right-wing president, and millions of people turned out on the streets saying, rather vote for a crook than a fascist. Chirac was seen as a crooked and corrupt politician, but at least he wasn't a fascist. And that was a very successful tactic at that time, because it led to a crushing defeat for Jean-Marie Le Pen. But it is a principle that has been weakening since then, since 2002, particularly due to the convergence between the far right, the right, and the center right on questions of immigration, law and order, and so on, and partly also because of the way that all the forces outside of the left, and even some within the left, within the center-left, have demonized La France Insoumise and the radical left, saying, well, you know, of course, we're against both extremes, as they call them, the far right and the radical left. But, you know, when it comes to it, maybe the far right isn't so bad compared to the radical left, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a tactic which no one really expected would resurge in this kind of powerful way. It's a dangerous tactic, and we're already seeing how dangerous it is, because the Macronistes are claiming that, you know, the fact that the left came first doesn't really mean anything. There's no absolute majority. You know, they have no right to form a government, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not a tactic that guarantees that the political results after it will be positive. But it is a tactic which worked in the negative sense of stopping the possibility of the RN being able to form the next government, which would have been a disaster.
I'm glad you went over all of that because it answers so many questions. But now, of course, the real question I think on everybody's mind is, will the center still block with the left to block the right? And who's going to lead? Who gets to form the government?
So this is a very turbulent period at the moment. I mean, the news changes by the minute, by the hour. And it's only been a few days since the legislative election results. And it feels like it's been 3 weeks. Essentially, what's happening at the moment is that there are, on the one hand, intense negotiations going on within the left about who would they put forward as their prime minister. And those are very complicated negotiations. La France Insoumise came first in the left. It's the biggest group within the left coalition. But the gap between them and the centre-left Socialist Party is much less than it was in 2002. 2002, France Insoumise had 50% of the seats, of the left seats. In this case, they look like they're getting 40 or less percent of the seats. And the centre-left is trying to claim, well, you know, the balance of forces has changed. It should be a Socialist Party prime minister rather than a La France Insoumise prime minister. So that's one thing that's going on. On the other hand, the Macroniste centre is in turmoil with enormous debates running through it. There's a right wing that is saying, well, you know, the majority of French people voted for some kind of right wing party, whether it was far right, center right, or whatever. And therefore, the next prime minister should be a right wing prime minister, despite the fact that the left is the biggest group. And in fact, you know, being extremely aggressive towards the left and saying, you know, if any minority government is formed by the left, which contains any member of the La France Insoumise or even the ecologists, they will immediately provoke a vote of no confidence and bring the government down. On the other end, the center camp, the so-called left, the softer part, if you like, are somewhat uncomfortable about this position and are in many cases pushing for what you would call a national unity government. So something that would go from the center left through to the center right, which would be a temporary government. The reality of the situation is that there can't be another dissolution of the assembly for a year. So we're stuck with this hung parliament for a year. So some kind of solution is going to have to be sorted out, whether it's a coalition government of this national unity type, which would be a pretty rotten solution in my view, or a minority government proposed by the left, which would be fragile and vulnerable to a no confidence vote at any point. The only thing that could unblock the situation, particularly before that year is out, would be Macron standing down as president and provoking early presidential elections. He doesn't have to do that. He has his term going until 2027, so he can eke it out until then, or he can decide to provoke presidential elections. He can't stand again himself, not allowed to, more than twice in a row, but he could try and do that to try and get give an advantage, I suppose, to the center candidate, whoever that might turn out to be.
Well, what about how strong is program an element in this? Because the far left, you know, one of the difficulties in getting the coalition together was to see if they would accept, you know, the far left platform, which was to undo the pension reform of Macron, to have more pro-immigrant policies, more investment in public services, ecological planning and the like. It was already a test to pull together the new Popular Front. But how much does its program figure in some of the squabbles that we're seeing today?
We call La France Insoumise here the radical left rather than the far left. The far left tends to refer to the Trotskyist and other extra parliamentary group. Okay. I mean, yeah, the program that left the Nouveau Front Populaire, the new Popular Front, put forward is very marked by the program of La France Insoumise. So it's about tax hikes on the rich. It's about going back on the pension reforms. It's about recognizing Palestine as a state, et cetera, et cetera. So it is very much marked by, if you like, a radical left imprint, which the socialists and ecologists and communists have had to accept because of the position of force of La France Insoumise. So far, nobody in the coalition has, certainly in the leadership of the coalition, has put that program into question. They have all said that those key measures, at least price freezes as well, you know, radical redistributive measures and some questions on international politics, nobody has said there should be compromises on those yet. And in fact, the leader of the Socialist Party, Olivier Faure, just after the second round, made a speech which was quite firm. It was quite similar in a way to Mélenchon's speech, saying, you know, we don't want to water down our program. It is true, though, that some of the right-wing elements of the Socialist Party are already saying, well, you know, we have to understand these RN voters. We should go converge with them on questions, understand where they're coming from on immigration and law and order. Since we don't have an absolute majority, we have to think about compromises with the Macronistes and so on and so forth. So that little discourse is clearly present. I think it would be suicidal for the other parties to the left to abandon the program in favor of a national unity government, because who would they be uniting with? You know, they would be uniting with people who are extremely right-wing on these, leave alone, you know, the international issues on the domestic front. I mean, Edouard Philippe, for example, who is positioning himself at the moment, he's on the right wing of the Macroniste camp. He was the previously a prime minister of Macron. He's in favor of raising the retirement age even more, from 65 to 67. He's in favor of big cuts in public spending and so on and so forth. So how would the socialists justify to their own electorate that have just put them in this position that kind of compromise? I mean, we know that social democrats are experts, world experts in treachery, but this would be a particularly self-harming form of treachery, quite obviously.
I think the big question, apart from who's going to form a government, is how realizable, given this division, the left's key platform aspects are in being realized. That's the one question. And then on the other hand, we need to talk about the right. I saw an interview with Marine Le Pen, and she was asked if she's still on the very far right. And she says, no. We're somewhere between the right and the left, which, you know, made the interviewer laugh. But you know, we need to talk about both of those things, Sebastian. So first, is it possible, given this hung parliament, for elements of the left program to be a sort of rallying cry in the next period? And secondly, how do you see the right, you know, relating to that?
Yeah, so the left, if the left were to form a government, it would be able to put through some measures immediately. Part of them would be through decrees rather than through laws. That's obviously problematic, given the way the left has criticized Macron in the previous period for pushing through things through decree, or using the 49.3 part of the constitution to push through very unpopular reforms like the pension reforms. But they could push through some emergency measures through decree. And the other thing they could do is they could call the bluff of the far right and say, well, you said you were against the pension reforms, so here we are. We want to cancel them. Are you going to vote against us, or are you going to vote for this reform? You know, try and expose them in the eyes of their own working class electorate. But obviously, it's problematic, because at any point, any of the other blocs can provoke a vote of no confidence, and the government could then fall. But I think generally the tactic of saying, well, look, we're sticking to our program. Our program benefits 90% of the population. Now we dare you to vote against these social and economic measures and bring the government down on that basis is probably the only way the left can go. Now, of course, as you say, part of this depends on how the far right position themselves. If you remember our previous conversation, I was telling you about how in the run-up to the elections, the far right was trying to cuddle up as closely as possible to the employers, to the boss class, to try and water down their social and economic demands or put them off as far as possible so that they would win a veneer of respectability and responsibility and so on and so forth. Do they want to go further in that direction and position themselves as, you know, another bourgeois party, basically, an alternative to the Républicain party? Or do they want to keep their working class base by still seeming anti-systemic, against the system? That's a big question they are going to have to ask themselves in this current situation. There are some signs, at least, of some internal, I wouldn't call it discussion or debate, because there's no real democratic debate within the far right. But there are voices within the far right who are saying, this election was screwed up, putting all these anti-Semites and fascists and nutcases on our electoral lists was a disaster. We should have filtered it properly. We should have been more professional. And the strategy was wrong. So it's possible that you would see some differentiation. I wouldn't imagine any splits or anything like that, but some differentiation and some strategic debate going on within the far right that might put them on the back foot with an offensive left government trying to push through these social and economic demands that, as I say, would benefit the vast majority of the population, including, of course, the RN voters.
I'd like to just end it, Sebastian, on your ideas about the historic opportunity for the left that exists right now and what it can mean, because all eyes are on France. And while other countries perhaps wish that, you know, there would be this kind of success for them in that it would indicate the decline of the right, even though the right did quite well, but that the left was stronger. How do you see those opportunities for the left? And I mean, in this case, the radical left and the far left, and I suppose the center left, in getting rid of the threat from the right and pushing through a, you know, truly progressive program.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the left, in terms of percentage of votes, is, you know, one of its lowest ebbs that it's been for many years. And that's partly because of the disastrous legacy of the previous left, center-left government, led by François Hollande from 2012 to 2017, that there was such a disastrous experience that the left vote has collapsed compared to what it was in 2012. And so the fact they were able to pull off this acrobatic victory in terms of parliamentary seats is an absolute miracle in many ways. I think the key question now is going to be, how can these political and electoral victories be combined with mobilization of key sectors of the trade union movement, of social movements, of ecological, radical ecological movements, feminist movements, and so on and so forth? How can these movements on the streets, in the workplaces, and more generally, how can they coagulate together and interact with the new popular front, potentially in a position of government? There are already calls, for example, by the CGT union and other people, the New Anti-Capitalist Party and others, for a big demonstration at the National Assembly calling for a left government. It's being already written off as a equivalent to the attack on the Capitol building by the right and the far right. But There is already talk, you know, of trying to create a big social movement behind the new popular front. It's difficult to do at the moment. Summer holidays in France. In France, we have holidays, unlike in the US, and they're quite long. So doing anything in July and August is a complicated thing to pull off. But perhaps if the situation is still open in September, that is a feasible prospect. That would be the way, if you like, this kind of fluke almost victory of the left in electoral terms could be turned into something deeper. If you had a strong social movement which could combine, push forward, defend, but also criticize the weaknesses of the electoral advance, you could see an interesting dialectic develop in that kind of context.
Thank you so much for bringing so much clarity to the situation. And of course, we'll come back to you as it unfolds, because France is going to be in the news for quite a while. And let's hope that this victory for the left over the right is a harbinger for other such victories around the globe. Thanks so much for joining our program today, Sebastian. He's the editorial director of Verso Books, and he's also on the editorial board of Historical Materialism, and he's our go-to person on France. Thank you so much, Sebastian.
Thanks very much.
Welcome back to the program. I am Susie Wiseman and really pleased to have Yasmin Mather back with us. She's the acting editor of Critique, a journal of socialist theory, and she's also worked with the Middle East Center at Oxford University, where she is also a scientific developer at Advanced Research Computing. You can read her many articles at Weekly Worker and also many other venues. And she's also quite active on YouTube and other places. So she's in the news. And what we're going to really talk about is that other surprise election. We had already mentioned the last a couple of weeks ago, you know, the turning of the tide in France, Britain, and Iran. But now we get a chance to really talk about Iran with Yasmin. And in that election, the reformist Masoud Pezeshkian defeated the hardliner Ali Jalili. I hope I'm pronouncing these right. And it signaled the public desire for change. Pezeshkian focused on social reforms, economic improvement, and renewed nuclear negotiations. But of course, his success depends on the supreme leader's approval, parliamentary support, and there are significant obstacles. But that presidential election really surprised everyone because it came at a time when most seemed to think that the hardliners were in firm control, even though there had been a lot of discontent over the last long time, actually. But even given all of that, and I'm sure Yasmin will confirm that not too many people were excited about this election, nonetheless, they came together and elected a moderate and a reformer in Masoud Pezeshkian as their president, and he presided with 3 million more votes than Jalili, who was a regime insider who did nothing much but mouth all of the regime's hardline positions on internal security and foreign policy. So no matter what happens next, this is such a dramatic turn of events. And of course, we've seen reformist governments in Iran before, but right now this just seems incredibly significant. And I think the questions are whether it'll set the stage for potential change in a nation that's grappling with deep-seated discontent and geopolitical turmoil, and whether or not we can really see a big breakthrough. And I guess I should just say before I ask you the first couple of questions, Yasmin, is just say to the listeners that this election came about, kind of a snap election, sort of like France, because the helicopter crash claimed the lives of the conservative President Raisi, the foreign minister, the governor, and five others. And so that had a lot of significant implications for Iran and the region, and of course, U.S.-Iran relations. So we have this critical juncture, have a moderate now, who will have to kind of, you know, maneuver to be able to act in Iran. And it's going on just as Israel would like more than anything to escalate the war against Iran. There is certainly, you know, the prospect that the Gaza war may expand to Lebanon, if it, you know, maybe you think it already has. And, you know, it raises all sorts of questions, not least our own elections coming up and who's in power and what that will mean. So, oh my God, a lot, Yasmin, but I'd love to get your view. First of all, I guess on the sort of overall situation. And I should just say, and I'm sorry for this long introduction, but the last time we spoke was to showcase that spectacular, massive women's protests that were all repressed. And of course, I think that's one of the reasons why we expected a low turnout, because those who were repressed and those who were allies of those who were repressed certainly did not want to vote, I think. And now we've seen this, you know, the other sort of situation. So what happened? How do you see what happened? And what do you expect?
I think you gave a very good, actually, a very good summary of the whole situation. But there are a couple of things that I'm not sure about because of the secrecy of both the Iranian government, but also the United States. But my understanding is that in Oman, the Iranian government officials and U.S. officials have been in discussions since maybe November, maybe October 2023. As these are not so secret, because at least the U.S. side admits that such discussions are taking place. And of course, they have to do with Gaza, with the situation in Gaza. They have to do with the possible escalation of the conflict. And I think both sides, Iran and the US, don't want an escalation of the conflict. But you wonder then if the helicopter crash gave Iran's supreme leader an opportunity. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. There are a lot of Iranians who do, and I don't believe in it. However, if you like, the election of a reformist president could have been avoided if the Council of Guardian, who listens to the supreme leader, had banned all reformist candidates. I was told early on in this election that having four conservatives, then we ended up with 3.5, but four conservatives and one reformist was actually to the advantage of the reformist, because they didn't have to choose a single candidate while the conservatives were fighting each other. And the two main candidates, Jalili and Ghalibaf, refused to withdraw for the sake of the other one. So in some ways, there was a little bit of advantage for the reformists. For ordinary people in Iran, the first round, I think, reflected what people thought, which was very lukewarm, 39.5%, something like that. This is obviously a situation of a half full cup, because some people say, oh, well, at least 39.5 voted. Others say, well, 60% didn't vote. I was surprised that all factions of the Iranian regime admitted that such a large percentage didn't vote. And you're absolutely right that this abstention reflects the dissatisfaction of those sections of the population who did support the Life Woman Freedom Movement. It also reflects the opposition of those sections of the population whose living standards have gone terribly down because of sanctions, because of inflation, because of corruption in the in the way the leaders of the Islamic Republic run the economy. In some ways, the survival of the reformist candidate gave the regime a breathing space, and they benefited from it. I think 50% is not a great turnout, but it's acceptable for the regime to pretend that this was okay. After all, quite 30 million did vote, so you can't. I don't think we should underestimate those who voted. Now, those who voted clearly hope and believe that there will be a reduction in the forcefulness of militia that attacks women for poor headscarf or for what they call an Islamic clothing. They certainly hope that there will be fewer arrests, no arrests maybe, but they also hope that what Pezeshkian promises, discussions with the West, the US, European Union, and the UK, irrespective of who is in power, and he's emphasizing he will talk to Trump, irrespective of who is in power, will improve the economic situation. Now, that is a big promise, partly because it will not be up to him. It will be entirely up to the US, the UK, the Western government. And amongst all this, as you rightly pointed out, he has to negotiate the supreme leader. The supreme leader can overrule anything he said. Contrary to some Iranian opposition groups, I would say that the supreme leader is not necessarily going to block everything he does. He will keep a close eye on everything Pezeshkian does, but it doesn't mean that he will block everything Pezeshkian does, for two reasons. the Supreme Leader wants an improved economic situation. If there is even a tiny reduction in economic deals, sanctions reduced, and so on. And at this stage, given what's going on in Gaza, given the threat of another war between Lebanon and Israel, and Iran's difficult position, should such a war start, the Supreme Leader does want to keep lines of communication with US open. I'm not saying he's agreeing to a peace deal with the US, but he does want communication to continue.
This is fascinating. And I just want you to go back before we go into Pezeshkian's, who he is, what his program might be, and then the limits of his ability to carry it out. Because you've just sort of outlined that, but just maybe for our listeners, can you explain the election system? Because what you said was that there were three candidates on the right and then a sort of half reformer. So it was it sets it up that, of course, the Iranians didn't do what the French did, you know, in this case, is to unite to win. But maybe you could explain the two-round system and the, I suppose, relative autonomy of the government from, if it exists, from the religious council and the supreme leader.
So I think about 40 candidates, maybe even more, presented themselves to the Ministry of Interior as candidates for the presidential election. They included at least two women, maybe more, but at least two women I saw. There's a confusion about women standing for presidency because the Iranian constitution uses the word rajul, which in Arabic means masculine. but the brave women did stand, and there are various interpretations of this. But anyway, the word is very clear. Obviously, none of the women were there. Remember that the previous, not much liked President Ahmadinejad presented himself as well. He was dismissed. And the Council of Experts decided that five candidates could go ahead. Four of them were supposed to be conservative. As I said, one of the four then turned up not to be as conservative or as the media had put him out to be. That's all I'm saying. And then of the four, two of them were really not serious candidates. The two serious candidates were Ghalibaf, who heads the Majlis, the parliament in Iran, and Jalili. Ghalibaf is very much a strong man, very close connections with the Revolutionary Guards. He claims he will be a dictatorial figure, but for the sake of the country. So you could imagine not many people actually vote for dictators. So he didn't get through the first round. Before the first round, two of the conservative candidates, the two who had almost no chance, withdrew. That left Ghalibaf, Jalili, the half-reformist, half-conservative Pur Mohammadi, and Pezeshkian. So in many ways, Pezeshkian had an advantage because the conservative vote was divided between the two, Jalili and Ghalibaf. Now, there's a lot of debate since then that conservatives are having a lot of arguments amongst themselves about lack of discipline, and so on. The reality is that all factions of the Islamic Republic have more conflict within themselves than they have with others. And that's true of the conservatives. So the two conservative candidates could not come to a compromise because they hated each other more than they hated Pezeshkian. And that worked to his advantage. To cut a long story short, the second round ended up between a straightforward reformist versus conservative. And I think people voted against the conservative more than voting for Pezeshkian. We can't deny the fact that he benefited from it. the only thing one can say at this stage was corruption was very much on the agenda. Many people hated the conservatives and many reformists for corruption. And Pezeshkian is cleaner, at least as far as we know so far, we could be surprised, than other politicians in the Islamic Republic.
This is also interesting. And we should say Pezeshkian is a cardiac surgeon. For those of us in the West, he's a complete unknown. I don't know if that's the case in Iran as well. You wrote that he was elected on a wave of unenthusiasm, which, of course, you've just started to explain. And, you know, that many people didn't turn up for the vote with, I guess, tepid expectation that anything could really change, especially after the turbulence and repression of the last years. And it's really interesting because what you've showcased, Yasmin, is that really what's at stake here is the deteriorating economy and the need to make some breakthrough in negotiations with the West to lift some of these paralyzing sanctions. And then, of course, to avoid a wider war in the Middle East with Israel. Those are all really, really important. But on the other hand, this candidate, Pezeshkian, said, you know, famously that he's not opposed to women choosing for themselves whether or not they want to wear the hijab. That's a tip to that huge women's movement. And then on the other hand, you see the supreme leader, rather, basically seeming to be okay with some reforms, but definitely not that one. You know, and that, and you still, I don't know, maybe you can tell the listeners, are there still the morality police, you know, watching for any sort of, you know, for any women not covering their heads? What is the sort of situation there? And you talked a bit about the divisions in the right and people who vote for the reformer, but is it the case that they actually support reform or they just don't like the corruption of the right?
One thing we have to say to explain is that he's now president-elect, I think sometime in August, the date is not very clear because it keeps changing, he will become president. So right now he has no powers, or at least he can't do much. We will have to see what will happen to the morality parades, what will happen on the street. My guess is that there will be slightly, not major, but slightly improved situation when it comes to social issues, including the headscarf. Maybe segregation of gender segregation in universities and so on. But we will have to see this. And I think the Supreme Leader is extremely manipulative in such issues, in that he will see if that benefits him, he will turn a blind eye to it. If he sees there is no benefit in it, he will change his mind. So that is very much in the open. In terms of economic policies, remember that the reformists are also involved in sections of the reformists, including the previous president, Rouhani, face accusations of corruption, which are not imaginary, they really exist. Pezeshkian is in a special position. My understanding is that as a cardiac surgeon, he was advised to set up private hospitals, private clinics. He refused, which presumably works in his advantage in terms of a man who claims to be with ordinary people. We will have to see. We have seen so many of these that we have to see. There is a precedence for reformist presidents who have ended up being quite powerless. Mm. And this precedence doesn't encourage people to be enthusiastic about reformists coming to power. So we had Khatami, who did some reforms. I can't deny that he did some reforms. However, when it came to crucial stages, he had difficulty confronting the many enemies that he faced. He faced major demonstrations by conservative militia, by conservative forces. Rouhani's presidency was even worse in that he promised economic reform. And of course, his only excuse was that Trump walked away from the nuclear deal. That was his only excuse. But in some ways, it wasn't just that, because he couldn't confront corruption in his own family. His son-in-law was called the Sultan of Bananas in Iran because he was the main importer of bananas. And actually, he made a huge fortune out of importing bananas. Sanctions benefit sections of the Islamic Republic. And this is something that the US and the West never seems to understand. If you sanction a dictatorship, individuals within a dictatorship, they have the power to, first of all, move their money to others who will be beyond this kind of sanction, but also they have the opportunity to use government funds to bring goods on the black market on official rates of exchange and sell it on the unofficial rate of exchange. And at times, they can make huge profits because of this, the way they deal with this. And of course, the beneficiary of sanctions in the Islamic Republic of Iran are both factions of the Iranian regime.
But on that, this is a really important issue, I think, because it's this blanket sanction regime fails almost everywhere that it's applied. And it always, you know, seems to benefit the government at the expense of the population who hurt the most from the sanctions. And I'm sure that they've crippled the economy in Iran. And as you've just explained, doesn't affect at least the parts of the regime or all of the regime. But, you know, we saw even in Russia, you know, that the issue of corruption was what boosted Navalny's fame and popularity. Of course, we saw the terrible end to that. But is this the explosive issue in Iran as well, that people, you know, see how corrupt the so-called religious forces are and that this is some sort of contradiction? Is it? And how is that seen? And do you see a sort of renewal of the social movement because they've been boosted by Pezeshkian's election?
I think it's absolutely true what you said, that the religious groups, including reformists and conservatives, have been the beneficiaries of sanctions. But corruption has become, if you like, systemic in Iran. Everyone realizes that anything you want to do, you have to pay a bribe, even on a small scale or a larger scale. So this is not new to Iran. The Shah's regime was very corrupt. I remember people talking of one of the Shah's brothers as Mr. 15%, in that any economic deals that was done in Iran, he was getting 15% of it. But of course, the Islamic Republic has taken this to a much higher level. And there is obviously a lot of opposition to this. People in Iran tell me that most ordinary families, working families, can't afford meat as any time in their daily or weekly diet. And you can imagine that vegetables aren't cheap in this system either. Rice, which was a part of a staple diet of Iranians, has become a luxury. It's become an expensive item. So people either have to buy very cheap, low quality rice, or they end up eating pasta, which is not part of any Middle Eastern diet. So you can imagine resentments are unbelievable. People are talking of depriving their children of essential good food, healthy food. And you then have people who, I'm told, they're called the sons and daughters of Ayatollahs, but it's not just Ayatollahs, it's people who are related to the regime who import Lamborghinis to Tehran. So everything horrible you hear about Qatar or Abu Dhabi, where, if you like, the sons and daughters of the emirs behave in a completely unbelievably corrupt and terrible, non-human way, you see it in Iran's Islamic Republic. And that is creating serious resentment amongst the youth who face unemployment. They all go to universities. There are a very large number of higher education establishments in Iran, but people graduate from it and they have no jobs. So you can imagine resentment is everywhere.
This is sort of like the Egyptian scenario, too, that led to the Arab Spring. So I guess that's the last question. What do we expect? The economy is demanding some sort of relaxation, which would possibly mean some sort of rapprochement with the West. And yet the theocracy is having difficulty holding on to its strict religious form of government. So
absolutely.
Also, you know, we didn't have time to talk about Russia, but I see this as potentially being very important in terms of movement against Russia's dictatorial push and repression as well. So once again, Iran is in a unique place in the world to kind of perhaps stir the kind of movement that we hope to see. Maybe I'm being too optimistic by saying that, but I like to always end on a moment of hope. Thank you so much, Yasmin, for joining us today. And of course, I'll call you again as we see how this unfolds, because we have no idea, as you say, at least until August, how this new government will begin to proceed and how the religious forces will react against it. But thanks for joining us on the program. And I should say Yasmin is the acting editor of Critique, a journal of socialist theory. You should look it up because it's well worth reading. And of course, disclosure, I'm also on the editorial board. Thanks for joining us today again.
Thanks very much, Susie.
Thank you. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Sebastian Budgen and Yasmin Mather. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, to producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor and engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. I'm Susie Wiseman. About it, cover
Art Podell, co-host of Roots Music and Beyond here at KPFK, inviting you to a celebration of folk music. August 17th and 18th, live at the Greek Theater, performing